think about those moments after something goes wrong, maybe a fender bender or a mistake at work, and that immediate urge, you know, to find someone to blame.
Oh, absolutely. That knee-jerk reaction.
But what if that actually blinds us to the bigger picture? Okay, let's unpack this. Today on The Deep Dive, we're diving deep into the surprisingly complex world of human error.
Exactly. And we tend to see human error as just, well, simple individual slip-ups. But based on our source material today, The Blame Machine, Why Human Error Causes Accidents, it's a PDF document. We're going to challenge that a bit.
Yeah. How so?
Well, we'll explore how human error is often really a symptom of deeper issues, you know, not just the root cause itself.
Precisely. And our mission for you today is to give you a shortcut to understanding this. We want to move beyond that blame game and start spotting the real reasons behind accidents.
Those aha moments.
Exactly. Those aha moments where things just click and you suddenly see the bigger picture. Mm. And hopefully without feeling overwhelmed by jargon or anything. So where do we even begin to shift our understanding of human error?
Well, I think a fundamental step is just understanding how the experts themselves define it. We've got two key perspectives here from the source. James Reason, back in 1990, he defined it as a failure of a planned sequence of mental or physical activities to achieve its intended outcome.
Okay.
And when these failures cannot be attributed to some chance agency. So notice his focus is really on the result. The plan didn't work out as intended.
Right. So it's about setting out to do something and, well, it doesn't pan out. That seems pretty straightforward. But Eric Holnagle offered a slightly different take in 93. What did he add?
Yeah, Holnagle defined an erroneous action as one which fails to produce the expected result and or which produces an unwanted consequence. Now, what's really interesting here, I think, is that Holnagle highlights the flawed action itself.
The action itself.
Yes, what he calls the phenotype. That signals an error, not just the eventual outcome. So even if things happen to turn out okay, despite a faulty action, the initial mistake still counts, in his view. It kind of shifts the focus from just counting accidents to recognizing the potential for them.
Huh. So even if you almost cause an accident but, you know, manage to recover, Holnagle would still say that initial action was an error. That's subtle, but yeah, important. But both Reason and Holnagle seem to agree on one central point, don't they?
Absolutely. Both perspectives emphasize that the significance, the real weight of a human error, is ultimately judged by its consequences. I mean, an error leading to a major disaster is, understandably, a much bigger deal than some minor hiccup with no real impact.
Right. Makes sense. So we have these definitions. They help frame our understanding. But gosh, with so many ways things can go wrong, how do we even start to categorize these errors? It could easily just become a muddled mess.
That's definitely where categorization systems or taxonomies come in handy. And one really fundamental way to group errors is into phenotypes and genotypes.
Phenotypes and genotypes.
Okay, think of the phenotype as the observable effect, what you actually see happen, the mistake itself.
Mm-hmm.
The genotype, then, is the underlying cognitive cause, what went wrong in someone's thinking or mental process that led to that observable error.
Okay, so phenotype the visible mistake, genotype the hidden reason behind it. Can you give us a clear example? How do these two interact?
Sure. Imagine a safety inspector. Their job is to spot defects on, say, a manufactured part, but they miss one. That missed defect, that's the phenotype, the visible error.
Got it.
But why did they miss it? Well, perhaps the lighting in their inspection booth was just inadequate. That poor lighting, the underlying factor impacting their ability to do the job effectively, that's the genotype.
Oh, okay.
You see, simply blaming the inspector for missing the defect, just focusing on the phenotype, it doesn't solve the real problem, does it? You need to investigate the genotype, the root cause, and in this case, fix the lighting.
That makes perfect sense. It's really about digging beneath the surface, isn't it? Finding the real fix. Now, the document also talks about different types of human behavior and the kinds of errors linked with each, using something called the SRK framework.
Yes, the skill-based, rule-based, and knowledge-based framework, SRK. It really helps us understand how our familiarity with a task influences the types of errors we're likely to make. Let's start with skill-based behavior.
Okay.
This involves those highly practiced, almost automatic tasks we perform. Well, almost on autopilot.
Like typing on a keyboard if you do it all day. Or maybe a surgeon performing a really routine procedure.
Exactly like that. In these kinds of tasks, errors often show up as slips, just unintended actions, like a momentary lapse in coordination, hitting the wrong key by mistake. Or they can be lapses.
Lapses.
Yeah, memory failures, like forgetting to complete a step in a routine, you know, perfectly well. an omission of a planned action.
Okay, so for those tasks we do without really thinking, we might have these little stumble slips in our actions or lapses in our memory. Got it. Now, what about rule-based behavior? What kind of errors are typical there?
Rule-based behavior kicks in during more familiar situations where we apply learned rules based on, you know, past experience. If this happens, then I do that.
Right.
Here, the errors often involve mistakes in selecting or applying the right rule. One common issue is misapplying a good rule to a situation that seems similar but actually has a crucial difference. James Reason famously called this strong but wrong behavior.
Strong but wrong. I like that.
Yeah, it's that tendency to stick stubbornly to a familiar rule even when the evidence is maybe suggesting it's not appropriate right now.
I can definitely picture that. Sticking to a familiar approach even when it's clearly not the best solution for this specific problem. What's the other type of rule-based mistake?
The other main one is applying a bad or inadequate rule. Maybe a rule that's based on a misunderstanding or just incomplete knowledge. Think of someone picking up a shortcut for using some software, but it only works in very specific circumstances.
Ah, okay.
And they apply it broadly, leading to errors in situations where it just wasn't meant to be used.
So it's either using the right tool in the wrong situation or maybe just having the wrong tool altogether. The document uses driving a car as a good example of how we switch between these. How does that work?
Driving is a fantastic illustration, yeah. On a familiar route, so much of what we do becomes skill-based, steering, accelerating, braking. It's almost automatic.
Mm-hmm.
But when we see a familiar yellow traffic light, we apply a rule. If I'm close, proceed. If further away, stop. That's rule-based. And then if we suddenly hit an unexpected road closure and have to figure out a totally new route.
Ah, okay, that's different.
That engages knowledge-based behavior problem solving in an unfamiliar situation. And that feeling when you arrive somewhere and you don't really recall parts of the drive.
Yeah, highway hypnosis.
Exactly. That's your brain operating in that super efficient skill-based mode.
It is a bit strange when you realize your brain was almost on autopilot. So what about when we do encounter completely new, unexpected situations? That falls under knowledge-based behavior, right?
Precisely. Knowledge-based behavior is what we rely on in novel situations where we don't have pre-existing rules or those well-worn routines. Mistakes here often happen during the actual process of forming a new plan, errors in our problem solving, because we're in uncharted territory, right? Our understanding might be incomplete or our reasoning might just be flawed.
Okay, so skill-based is efficient, but can lead to maybe a lack of attention. Rule-based is quick, but prone to misapplication. And knowledge-based is for figuring things out, but it carries that inherent risk of mistakes in our actual thinking. Now, the document also mentions this principle of cognitive economy. What's that about?
Ah, the principle of cognitive economy. It suggests that our brains tend to favor rule-based behavior whenever possible. Why? Because it demands less mental effort. It's just more efficient to apply a stored rule than to consciously analyze every single situation from scratch.
Makes sense. Less work for the brain.
Right. But as we've kind of touched on, the risk is when we inappropriately apply that rule-based approach to a situation that really requires more thoughtful, knowledge-based analysis.
It's fascinating, isn't it? How our brain's efficiency, something we usually see as a good thing, can actually be a vulnerability in safety-critical situations. That drive for shortcuts, sometimes it can blind us.
Yeah, our brain's looking for the easy route, even if it's not always the safest one in that specific context. And you also mentioned continuity of attention related to skill-based behavior.
Mm.
How does that link to errors? Well, with those highly practiced skill-based tasks that require less conscious thought, our attention can sometimes drift. While this lets us perform smoothly, it can also lead to a decrease in vigilance. We might fail to notice subtle changes in the environment or the task itself that could indicate a problem developing.
So it's almost like we get so good at something
that
we stop paying close enough attention.
Precisely. Our expertise can, paradoxically, make us less alert in some ways.
Okay. Let's shift gears slightly. The document also discusses violations. Now, how are those different from the unintentional errors we've been talking about? Slips, lapses, mistakes.
Violations are fundamentally different because they are intentional deviations. Deliberate choices to breach established operating procedures, rules, or safe work practices. Unlike errors, which are generally unintentional, violations are a conscious decision not to follow the prescribed way.
So someone knowingly taking a shortcut that bypasses a safety check, for instance, that'd be a violation?
Exactly that. And violations can be classified based on how often they occur. You have routine violations, which sadly can sometimes become the norm in a workplace.
Oh, wow.
Versus occasional violations. They can also be categorized using that same SRK framework. For instance, a knowledge-based violation might happen in really unusual circumstances where someone makes a conscious decision to deviate from standard practice based on their assessment of a unique situation. Maybe a driver exceeding a mandated rest period because of an unforeseen emergency.
Okay. Adapting to the situation, maybe. And what about rule-based violations? How do those look?
Rule-based violations are more what people typically think of, I suppose. The intentional disregard of written rules and procedures. These can often become routine, like an operator who regularly silences a warning alarm without actually investigating the underlying cause. It's a conscious decision to override a safety mechanism.
It's striking, though, that even these deliberate violations can often have deeper systemic roots. It's not always just about individual recklessness, is it?
Absolutely not. Often violations happen because rules are seen as impractical, or they're poorly communicated, or maybe there's pressure, perceived or real, to prioritize other goals, like hitting production targets, over sticking strictly to safety protocols. Understanding those underlying organizational factors is just crucial if you want to prevent future violations effectively.
This really does underscore the point that accidents are rarely simple. It's usually this whole web of contributing factors. Now, the document introduces two more important concepts, latent and active errors. What's the key difference there?
Right. Active errors are those that have pretty immediate consequences. They're typically quite visible right at the operational level. Think of a surgeon making an incorrect incision during an operation. Immediate effect.
Okay, direct cause and effect.
Exactly. Latent errors, on the other hand, have consequences that are delayed, and they often originate much further back in the system in, say, flawed designs, poor management decisions, or maybe underlying organizational weaknesses. These latent errors can lie dormant for a long time, almost like hidden traps.
Hidden traps, yeah.
Before they combine with an active error or some other factor to actually trigger an accident.
So a latent error is like this hidden vulnerability in the system, just waiting for the right trigger to cause a problem later on.
Precisely. And because their effects are delayed, latent errors can be much, much harder to identify and address proactively. They're often the silent contributors to accidents.
Can you give us a concrete example to really illustrate that difference?
Sure. Think about the BP Grangemouth explosion mentioned in the source. The fact that a safety valve on a piece of equipment was undersized, that was a latent design error. It didn't cause an immediate problem when it was installed.
Right. It just sat there.
Exactly. But years later, when a gas release occurred, that pre-existing design flaw directly contributed to how severe the explosion was. The active error might have been something an operator did during the plant startup, but the magnitude of the consequences was massively influenced by that underlying latent design flaw.
That's a really powerful illustration. So even if we just focus on the operator's immediate action, we're missing a huge piece of the puzzle, those pre-existing vulnerabilities baked into the system. This naturally leads us to think about the role of management and organizational factors, doesn't it? How they contribute to these latent errors.
Absolutely. Errors in management decision-making can have really widespread safety implications. Think back to the Flixboro disaster again. The decision to install that temporary bypass pipe without proper engineering oversight, that was largely driven by pressure to maintain production. It was a significant management error in decision-making.
A calculated risk that went wrong.
And the absence of a qualified mechanical engineer on site to really assess the safety of that temporary fix. That just compounded the issue. These were latent conditions created by management choices.
So decisions made way up at a higher level, seemingly far removed from the shop floor, can actually sow the seeds for future accidents through these latent conditions.
Exactly. And then we have what the source calls cultural errors. These are the deeply ingrained organizational norms, values, beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
If an organization's culture implicitly or even explicitly prioritizes production or cost cutting over safety,
mm-hmm.
if communication channels are poor, if there's a lack of clear accountability for safety, these cultural errors can create an environment where both active and latent errors are just more likely to happen and less likely to be caught and fixed effectively.
Hi.
The Herald of Free Enterprise ferry disaster was such a tragic example. That ingrained culture of, you know, pushing the limits on loading, poor communication between crew members, no clear responsibility for making sure the bow doors were actually closed.
Yeah.
That organizational culture directly contributed to the catastrophe.
It really highlights that safety isn't just a rule book. It's woven into the entire fabric of how an organization operates, thinks, and makes decisions. Now, this all sounds incredibly complex and maybe a bit daunting when we think about trying to predict and prevent accidents. Is there actually a way to quantify the likelihood of human error? I think that's where human reliability analysis, HRA, comes in.
Yes, exactly. Human reliability analysis, or HRA, provides a set of methods to try and estimate the probability of a human error occurring during specific tasks. This is often expressed as a human error probability, or HEP, which is essentially the ratio of the number of errors observed for a particular task compared to the total number of opportunities there were to make that error. It's usually expressed as a probability, often a very small number.
So we're trying to put a number on the chance of someone messing up. That sounds really difficult to do accurately. What are some of the key things that influence this probability?
Well, numerous factors, which are collectively known as performance-shaping factors, or PSFs. Yes, PSFs. They can significantly impact the HEP. These include things like how complex is the task, how much time does someone have, what are their stress levels, fatigue, their experience, training, what's the design of the equipment and workspace like the ergonomics, how demanding is the task on their attention.
Lots of variables.
Loads. And interestingly, the source points out something counterintuitive. A complex task performed by someone who's well-trained, attentive, and has good support might actually have a lower error rate than a simple, monotonous task carried out under high levels of distraction or fatigue.
That's definitely not what you'd instinctively think. So being too comfortable or bored on a simple task could actually be riskier if the conditions are bad.
It seems so. It flips the way you might think about it. So those seemingly simple tasks can be surprisingly risky if the conditions aren't right.
Now, the document briefly mentions some techniques used within HRA to predict these HEP values. Can you give us a quick overview of a couple?
Certainly. One of the earlier, more established techniques is TERP. That stands for Technique for Human Error Rate Prediction. This method relies heavily on historical data error rates for very specific, often quite granular tasks.
Okay, very detailed.
Very detailed, yes. But a potential limitation is that a lot of this data comes from studies of older technologies. So applying it directly to modern computer interfaces, for example, might be tricky. Think of TERP as looking at very specific steps in a recipe and knowing from past data how often each step tends to go wrong.
Okay, so detailed, but maybe not always perfectly current. What's another approach?
Another common one is HART, the Human Error Assessment and Reduction Technique. HART takes a broader view. It uses generic baseline human error probabilities for more general types of tasks.
More general types.
Yeah. And then it considers the influence of what it calls error-producing conditions, or EPCs. These are factors in the work environment or the person's state that can make performance less reliable. So instead of focusing on tiny steps, HART is more like saying, okay, for any baking task performed under time pressure, the error rate tends to increase by this much.
Right, so different levels of granularity both seem like potentially useful tools for trying to anticipate where human errors might pop up in complex systems. Now, when we look at a sequence of tasks, are errors always just isolated events? Or can one error make another one more or less likely?
That's a great question. Errors are often not isolated. They can exhibit what's called error dependency.
Error dependency.
It means an error in one task can influence the probability of an error in a subsequent, often related task. This coupling between errors can happen for various reasons. Maybe the tasks are very similar, or they're performed in the same challenging environment, or the person is under stress or time pressure that carries over.
So if someone makes a mistake on one step of a procedure because they're feeling rushed, they might be more likely to make another mistake on the next step because of that same continued pressure.
Precisely. That would be an example of positive dependency. One error increases the chance of another.
Yeah.
But you can also have negative dependency, where making an error might actually make someone more careful and vigilant, reducing the chance of error on the next task.
Oh, interesting.
And in some cases, you get complete dependency, where if the first error occurs, a subsequent error becomes almost certain. The example given in the source is a technician failing to install a critical O-ring on one engine during maintenance.
Right.
The underlying factors that led to that first omission, maybe poor lighting, fatigue, distraction, might very well lead to the exact same omission on other similar engines they work on shortly after. Think about it like being stressed after a near-miss driving in the morning. You might be more jumpy and maybe prone to other small errors later that day.
That makes intuitive sense.
Yeah, one mistake can sometimes set off a kind of chain reaction. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens after an error occurs? Is it always a direct path to an accident? Or are there ways to catch and correct them?
Thankfully, no. Not all errors lead directly to accidents. There are error recovery mechanisms. These are ways an error can be detected and corrected before it results in serious consequences.
Okay, like safeguards.
Exactly. This might involve the person who made the error realizing their mistake, maybe another team member spotting it, or even automated safety systems kicking in to halt a dangerous process.
So, what makes these recovery mechanisms more or less effective in a given situation? What influences whether recovery happens?
Several factors are critical there. First, how detectable is the error? Is it obvious that a mistake has happened? Second, how much time is available to take corrective action? Is there a window of opportunity? And third, how recoverable are the consequences? Even if we spot the error, is it already too late to prevent a bad outcome?
And it's really important to be aware, as the source notes, that we can sometimes overestimate how reliable these recovery factors will actually be in the real world. We can't always count on someone else catching our mistakes or on having enough time.
Yeah, it sounds like relying too heavily on the idea that someone will catch it is a pretty risky approach. The document even mentions a rather unusual example of an error recovery mechanism for maintaining operator alertness, a one-legged stool. You have to tell us about that one.
Ah, yes, the one-legged stool. It's a rather, let's say, unconventional solution described from a chemical plant. An operator had to monitor a reactor temperature gauge, right? But the task was so monotonous, so boring.
I can imagine.
That they were prone to falling asleep, which obviously could have led to a dangerous overheating situation.
Yeah.
So the error recovery mechanism. They gave the operator a one-legged stool to sit on.
Nope.
Yes. If they started to doze off, they'd lose their balance, start to tip, and hopefully jolt themselves awake. Crude, perhaps, but apparently effective in that specific context for combating a very human fallibility drowsiness in a high-stakes environment.
Wow, that's certainly memorable. Not sure I'd want that job, but okay.
Yeah.
Now, bringing all these concepts together, slips, lapses, mistakes, violations, latent errors, recovery, the document looks at human error within event sequences and uses several real-world case studies. How does this framework help us understand why accidents happen?
Well, we can use tools like event trees to sort of map out the sequence of events that could lead to an accident. These trees help visualize how human errors at different points in that sequence can influence the final outcome.
Like a flowchart of failure?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
They help identify potential pathways to failure and even estimate the overall likelihood of an accident by considering the probabilities of individual human errors and the chances for recovery at each stage.
Yeah.
And the case studies highlighted in the document, things like Slicksboro, the Herald of Free Enterprise, Hatfield Rail Crash, Chernobyl.
Major incidents.
Huge incidents. They offer these stark, real-world examples of how different types of human errors, often combined with those hidden, latent organizational weaknesses, can contribute to really tragic events. Mm-hmm. This is where it all comes together, you know? The decision to install that bypass pipe at Flixboro wasn't just a snap judgment by one person. It was framed by management decisions, production pressures, those latent errors setting the stage.
You've mentioned several really significant incidents there. What's the overarching lesson, the big takeaway, from examining these real-world examples through this lens of human error analysis?
I think the overwhelming and really consistent message from looking at these cases is that accidents are very, very rarely the result of just a single, isolated instance of human carelessness by one individual.
It's never that simple.
Almost never. Instead, they're typically the end result of a complex interplay. You have active errors, yes, but they're often initiated or amplified by underlying latent errors in the design of the system, in management decisions, in the overall organizational culture. So simply assigning blame to the individual who made the most immediate, visible error often completely misses those crucial underlying systemic issues.
And that means...
And unfortunately, that makes similar accidents more likely to happen again in the future because the real root causes haven't been addressed.
So it really is about looking beyond the most obvious mistake and understanding the much broader context in which these errors occur. Well, we've certainly covered a huge amount of ground in this deep dive into the complexities of human error. To try and bring it all together, what's the single most important takeaway you'd want our listeners to remember from all this?
I think the most critical understanding, really, is that human error in accidents is almost never solely about individual fault. It's usually a symptom, a red flag, if you like, indicating deeper organizational, systemic, and design issues, issues that create the conditions where errors are more likely to happen, and crucially, where they're more likely to have severe consequences.
And what's the value for you, our listener, in grasping this perspective? Why should you care about this shift away from just blaming?
Well, by understanding this framework, you now have a much more insightful way of looking at why accidents happen. You can move past that natural human tendency to immediately point fingers and instead start to appreciate the intricate web of factors that contribute to these events. And, you know, this understanding can empower you to think more critically about safety in your own life, in your own work.
So perhaps a final thought for everyone listening. As you go about your day, maybe take a moment to consider the various systems you interact with. At your workplace, sure, but also in transportation, maybe even complex things in your own home. Where might those hidden, latent errors be lurking, just waiting perhaps for an active error to trigger an unwanted incident? And what small changes could we proactively make to those systems to make them more resilient, more forgiving of the inevitable fallibility that comes with being human? It's a fascinating thought to ponder. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.